I'm Juanita Westall, and I'm from Louisville, Kentucky. Hi, everybody. Oh, I got that much over. I'm not usually intimidated by crowds, but when I'm surrounded by the talent that I see here, I am a little intimidated this morning. I'm a member of the Shively Al-Anon group, and it just happens to be the best Al-Anon group in the world. And I say that without any reservations, because the people in my group know the worst of me, and they love me anyway. He said, pull this down. I'm sorry. Okay. Our children grew up in Alateen. They were too young to go when they went, and they grew up. The younger ones just grew up going to meetings. And my husband says he's an alcoholic, and I agree with him. That was the nicest thing I ever called him. I'll settle down in a minute and get to talking, but I said last night when Bob was giving his big T with a capital T and all that, I said, now I talk that fast, but I don't make sense. He did. But I'll get into it. I don't know why I get so nervous when I'm starting. I think it's because I'm going to have to take my inventory at a public level and tell you what I used to be like. And I'm glad to tell you what happened and what I'm trying to be like today, but that what I used to be like, it still shakes me up a little. I know that I must never forget what I used to be like so that I can work on what I'm trying to do in my life today. I'm an only child. I was an only grandchild, and I was spoiled, and I was used to getting my way. And my grandmother was a little bit 4'10", 190-pound of fiery red hair Irish grandmother. And every time I threw a temper fit, the whole family thought it was really cute because I was just like my grandmother. And I grew up thinking a temper was a good thing to have because it got me a lot of things. If I threw a big enough fit, I usually got what I wanted, and I went through life like this. I'm not proud of that. Thank God Al-Anon's helped me to control that temper. When I was a very, very young little girl, my uncle came to live with us, and this was the greatest guy in the world. All alcoholics usually are, aren't they? He was terrific. He was full of life. He was full of fun. He was always ready to play and enjoy things. And I loved him with all my heart. I just loved him until Friday night. And he would come home carrying a bucket of beer. Now, you know, the little pail of beer, I used to say a six-pack, but I got honest enough in the program to admit it was a pail of beer down from the corner tavern. And the minute I see him with that pail in his hand, I hated him. I hated him with the same fierce feeling that I had loved him before, because I knew he was going to get drunk, and I knew he was going to stagger out of the house to go back to the bar time and time again to fill that pail of beer, and he was going to embarrass me, and I hated him. And by Monday morning, I would have worked up a real good fury against him, and then he would go to work all hungover, and Monday night, he would come home loaded down with candy and dolls and toys and make up to me, and I liked that. And I would let him make up for 2 or 3 days before I'd forgive him. This set another pattern in my life because I treated my alcoholic the same way. When I said that this uncle, his drinking did get worse. He lost. He married and had a family and lost them. And he ended up killing himself by jumping out of the Brown Hotel in Louisville, Kentucky, top floor window, in a blackout. And he lived for 9 days and had no recollection of having jumped. So when I say that my uncle was an alcoholic, I think it's safe to say that he was. He did this. He didn't want to be the way he was. And, you know, they say if they walk like a duck and quack like a duck, it's safe to call them a duck. And I really believe that my uncle did not want to be the way he was. I went through school maintaining the attitude that I will never marry a man who drinks. Nothing doing. I had had it with my uncle. That was just terrible that he drank like that. And I would never marry a man who drank. And I stuck to that all through grade school. And I got into high school, and you know these guys, all drank. They were football players and baseball players and basketball players. And after a big game, everybody went out to a party and everybody drank. And so my attitude changed. If I was going to date, I was going to have to date somebody who drank. So my attitude changed. Now, I didn't like the ones who drank too much, and my husband was one of them. Now, he says that we broke up more before we were married than we did after we got married. I think we got married to stop the breaking up. But we did. We dated through high school, and we broke up a lot. And then after high school, Bob went away to be a professional baseball player, and I thought that was great that he was gone away. I went about my own making a life for myself, and he came back and announced we were going to get married. And I said, no way, I'm not going to marry you. The night he gave me my engagement ring, he was sitting there and asking me to marry him, and I kept saying, no, I will never marry you. You drink too much. You have a problem. And he said, that night he sat there, and he looked me straight in the eye, and he says, do you believe that after we're married and I have responsibility, that I'll drink like this? And before the evening was over, I apologized to him, and I asked him to give me my ring. The insanity was already there. So we married. Now, I made him promise not to touch a drop on our wedding day, and bless his heart, he didn't. He really didn't have to. He was so hung over and so sick he couldn't stay at the altar through the marriage ceremony. He left the church 4 times. And my aunt kept thinking he was trying to get away, and she went around to the sacristy to shoo him back in. But you see, I did another thing too. I married a man my mother and my dad did not want me to. They said he drank too much, and they recognized the symptoms, and they didn't want me to marry him. And, you know, saying don't do it is like waving a red flag. And so I married him to prove to them that the love of a good woman would change him. And, you know, it did. He got worse. So we married and we were having fun. We went to a lot of parties. We did a lot of things together and we had a lot of fun. You know, they were not all bad days. There was a lot of good days in there and a lot of fun days with a lot of friends and a lot of really good times. Then we had our first little girl, and I just thought this was wonderful. I wanted a big family. We discussed this before we married. I told Bob that I wanted a big family, and he agreed that it was okay with him. And I told God I wanted a big family, and I used to say that I prayed real hard for 6 children, and God looked down and sent me 9. He saw that number upside down, I suppose. And that'll keep you from counting from here on. There are 9 of them, 9 beautiful, healthy children. And that's my only talent. I have had 9 kids. I can't sing and I can't dance. And everywhere we go, people ask me, how did he find time to be an alcoholic? Well, you have to remember that it only takes 1 time. And besides that, we never did get that mad. Well, when the child number 2 came along, this was my point of reaching a decision. You know, I was growing up and I was maturing and I was the mother of 2 children. And I thought it was time we settled down and stopped these parties every night and stopped running around to, you know, out-of-town trips just to get drunk and things like that. I announced to Bob that we were older now, we had a family, and we were going to settle down and we were going to raise these children and be good parents. And he agreed with me. He thought I ought to do that. And he let me. And so I stayed home, and Bob went on doing the same things he'd been doing before. And this is where the resentments and the anger started. Now, it wasn't really bad right then. We had child number 3, and we had child number 4, and they were all 4 little girls. And by this time, his drinking was really affecting me. I mean, I was angry most of the time. I couldn't enjoy a good day because I was projecting for the next drunk and knowing that he was going to hurt me again. And reacting without there even being a drink taken. So I wasn't really living in the present. I was existing. But I remember his brother at this time, who's an alcoholic, was really drinking bad, and he was, in fact, he'd lost his home and was on Skid Row. And at this particular time, I started wondering what made his brother drink and what was making Bob drink. Well, the common denominator was that Norman had all girls and Bob had all girls. So that had to be the reason they drank. They needed a boy. Well, now, Roseanne couldn't do anything about Norman, but I could do something about Bob, and I told God it had to be a boy, and the next one was. Child number five was a boy. And I can remember laying in that hospital just so excited, waiting for Bob to come in. You know, I had done this for him. I had given him a son. And I laid there waiting for him to come in and take me in his arms and tell me that this boy was what he'd always needed and he would never drink again. I waited 3 days. He was out celebrating his son and forgot to come see me. The rage, the anger that I felt in those days, I would, you know, I had killed him about seven different ways. I had divorced him. I had all the terrible things I could think of I had done to him. And when he finally came through the door, he had baseball gloves and football equipment and all these things, and I just melted. You know, he was going to be a father to this little boy, and that was okay with me then. You know, everything was all right. We took that little boy home, and a year later, we had a second little boy, and I thought, well, if one can't, two can. And I really did, you know, as long as I had a goal, as long as I had something I could set my eyes on and say, when we get to this place, he'll quit drinking. Then I could live through the interim. I could make it through those days if I had that goal in sight. And these little boys were going to get him sober. But it was on the first little boy's second birthday that I ran over to the store and bought him a little electric razor. And it was battery operated, you know, and it was a little cute little thing that when you plugged it in, it buzzed. And when the kid opened it up, he says, "What is it?" And I said, "Honey, it's a razor. You shave with it." And that little fella raised his pants leg to shave his leg. Now, that may not sound like much to you, but it was an earth-shattering thing to me because it meant that he didn't know what his father did with a razor. And I went down and filed suit for divorce. Now, I did this a lot. Now, I wasn't foolish. You see, I used to work for this attorney, and I could do it for free. So I filed suit for divorce to scare him sober, and it worked for about 3 weeks. And I was pregnant again. We did a lot of making up. But with this child, it was different because this was the seventh one, and I got to thinking, you know, I am going to divorce him. Sooner or later, I'm going to go through with it because he's not getting any better. He's getting worse, and I'm going to have to quit having these kids because I'm not going to be able to support anymore. I couldn't support four, let alone seven, but this was my thinking. But at this time, it really was changing in me. I was getting so bitter and so sick. Now, mind you, I was the outgoing kind. I was the kind that did everything. I was the PTA president and the Alter Sedality president and a groom mother at the same time at school. I was all things to all people. But about this time, with this pregnancy, that's when the disease manifested itself the most in me because I withdrew. I just locked myself in. I couldn't answer the phone. I didn't want to because they were usually bill collectors. And if it wasn't a bill collector, it was a friend who had a good marriage. And who wants to talk to them? I lied to everybody. I lied to the bill collectors. I lied to, you know, the people around me. But when in this pregnancy was when my brother-in-law had found AA. And the whole family thought it was ridiculous. We come from a small farming community, and they're almost all of German families, and they have these big German parties all the time. You know, you have a party for a first communion or a death, anything that's a reason for a party, and everybody drinks beer and eats potato salad and ham sandwiches. And whenever Norman would go to one of these parties, after he would get back home and sober up a little bit, somebody would stick a beer in his hand and say, "You know, Norman, go ahead. Learn to drink like a man." And I would always say, "Norman, put it down. It's that first one that gets you drunk." And Norman was in AA for about 3 weeks, and he came by the house to borrow a shirt and tie. And he sat down beside me, and he says, "You know, Juanita," he said, "you were right." He said, "It was the first beer that always caused me trouble." And he said, "That's what they tell us in AA." And, you know, I just melted. My God, this man was telling me I was right. I had been wrong for so long with this man. You know, I would catch Bob in a lie, and I would prove it to him that he had told me the lie in every way I knew how. And when I'd finally get through with all my proof, he'd say, "So what?" And I'd just fall apart. I couldn't, you know, I was always racing with this need to convince him he was wrong and that he was doing wrong. And I never quite convinced him. I never got through to him. And here's this brother-in-law sitting here telling me that I'm right and that, that he had found this new way of life. And I said, "Then you've got to get Bob to go." And he says, "Honey, it doesn't work that way. He has to want it for himself." And I thought, well, then I'll get him to want it for himself. So I kept asking Norm to take him, and Norm kept saying, "Honey, I can't, not till Bob wants to go." So they were going on a fishing trip. The two of them loved to fish a lot together, and they were going on a fishing trip, and I hated these fishing trips because they usually meant that he was going to be drunk nonstop and spend money we didn't have to spend, and I could give you a thousand reasons, but most of them was that I hated him, and I didn't want him to be happy doing anything. And so that, when fishing was, you know, one form of pleasure, and I didn't want that. So I got to thinking about these fishing trips, so I said to Bob, whenever, it must have been around 4 o'clock in the morning, that was our usual communication time. I told him, I said, "Now listen," I said, "you're going fishing with Norman, and he's sober." And I said, "You're going to do something and get him drunk, and you ought to be ashamed of yourself." And he says, "I'm not going to do anything to get him drunk." And I said, "Yes, you are." And we had our little, you know, fun game. "No, I'm not." "Yes, you are." And I said, "Then why don't you go to one of those meetings and find out how you can help Norman stay sober?" And he says, "Well, if it'll help Norman stay sober, I'll go." And he did. Now, the night that Norman picked him up, I thought that this was it. This was our happily ever after. I could just see our life stretching out in front of us. And off they went, you know, and 10:20 there, the car pulls in the driveway. No car ever pulled in our driveway at 10:20. But his pulled up in the driveway, and Bob gets out, and I'm waiting at the door with open arms. You know, now he's going to take me in his arms and say, "I love you, and I'll never drink again." He shook his finger in my face and he said, "I can't keep Norman sober, and you'll never take another night out of my life." And he went out and got drunk, and I thought, my God, he is so far gone, I'm going to have to go and get this for him. And that's what I did. I called my brother-in-law and I said, "We want to go to a meeting, the next meeting you're going to." And he says, "Well, that's Friday night." This was a Tuesday. And I said, "Well, we want to go." So Tuesday and Friday night, I told Bob, I said, "Norman says that you didn't give it a fair trial. I think you ought to go back again." So we went back to the Friday night meeting. And I sat down. We walked in the door. I have to tell this because we walked through you have to always climb up steps to get to an AA meeting. I don't know why. Your knees are shaking and you're just hardly able to walk, and you got to go up these big flight of steps. But we got up there, and this really beautiful, attractive woman comes running across the room, and she grabs Norman and hugs him and kisses him. And I thought, "Don't reach for mine, sister." Now, I didn't want him, but I wasn't going to give him to her. I still had hopes of getting him sober. And you know, she didn't. She stuck her hand out, and she said, "You must be Norm's brother, Bob." And Bob, Norm must have been talking about us. And then she turned around to me, and she says, "Honey," she says, "are you going to stay down here with us drunks or go upstairs and learn how to live with your drunken husband?" And I almost died. God, she called my husband a drunk in public. Where's Lavender? Oh! But, you know, I wanted in that room. Bob had already been in there and hadn't gotten it, and I knew if I got in there, I'd get it. And so I put on my two-face, and I smiled at her sweetly, and I said, "I'm going to stay here with him. He needs me." Now, I can qualify this statement that he hadn't needed me for 2 years. Because, and I can prove it, because between Mary Rose and Missy, there's 2 years and 9 months. We hadn't even shook hands in passing in the hall. We were so angry with one another. But that night he needed me, and I sat right in that front row, and I heard that AA speaker, and I found my home. I was where I belonged. I sat there and heard him talk. Now, it seems to me, I've heard this man talk many times since, and he's a good AA speaker, but it seemed to me that all he talked about that night was his wonderful wife and how she had stood by him and kept the home together and kept the food on the table, done all these wonderful things, and how she had helped him in the program to help his sobriety have depth. And I thought, anything that can get my husband up in front of a room full of people to tell him how wonderful I am is what I got to get for him. And I went to AA meetings with a vengeance. I went back to AA time and time again. You have to remember, I was a very aggressive person, and it was hard to push me out of a closed meeting because I could talk my way right on in there, and I stayed right in there, and I listened. But remember this. It took me years to wonder why I was so comfortable in AA. But you see, I had been taking an alcoholic inventory for years, and I was right there at home when they talked about their inventory. I was taking his while they talked. If he would do this, then we'd be happy. If he would do that. And I used to tell him, if you just quit drinking, everything will be perfect. And his sponsor and my sponsor have fed those words back to me for 20-some-odd years. You see, my first Al-Anon meeting was in Louisville, and there were only 6 meetings in the area, and it was in February of 1960. And Al-Anon was real small, and it was real new in our area, just 2.5 years old at the time. And they had a live one, and they couldn't catch me, because I wasn't going to those meetings. I didn't want to join the auxiliary. I wanted in the real program. And I told them so. And the AAs were kind to me. They let me come, and they would talk to me. And after the meetings, we went to meetings when they didn't have these nice styrofoam cups. They had regular old crock cups, and we had to wash them after the meetings. And you know, I got more help over that sink of hot, sudsy water washing those cups than I ever have any place else in the program. I think that when they say action's a magic word. Finally, these 2 really old ladies, and I mean they were old and crickety and meaner than snakes, got one on one side and one on the other, and they said, "Honey, you don't belong in AA." And I said, "I know that. I'm only coming to get him sober." And they said, "You don't belong here at all. You belong in Al-Anon." And I said, "No, thank you. I'm not joining anything." I was a joiner. You know, I joined everything. And I always ended up doing all the work because I volunteered. But I wasn't going to get involved in this. I had one goal, and that was to get him into AA and get him sober. And then I could retire. But one was on one side and one was on the other. And the one said to the other one, says, "I really think that we can help you." And I said, "Help me what?" And they said, "Honey, you come with us and we'll help you." Well, I thought they meant getting sober, so I went like a lamb. And I got in that little room around this little table, and there they sat, and they opened up their meeting in the usual manner, and then they wanted to talk about my character defects. And I didn't have any. I didn't. I couldn't even go to confession on Saturday nights because I couldn't think up anything I had done bad. Now, to qualify that statement, I have to tell you that the lying to the bill collectors was necessary. The lying to my mother was necessary. She'd have killed him. And later on, I'll prove that. The lying to his parents was necessary because they needed to know how bad he was. And I embellished it a little. When he came in at 2 o'clock in the morning, and I was standing there screaming and cursing this man, it was not my fault. It was his. If he wasn't doing the things he was doing, I wouldn't be behaving this way. God knows I was not this kind of person. And when they wanted to talk about character defects, I was a little put off. And they went on talking, and they talked around me, and they tried to talk to me, and I would just pass. And then they talked about their resentments, and I didn't have any. I hated every woman in that room for having a sober husband. You know, because they didn't look like they were any better than I was. And they talked about self-pity, and God knows I did not have that. I never had self-pity. And to this day, I still have to work on that particular character defect, but I didn't think I had it then. And I went to these meetings because they had made it quite clear that I didn't belong in the AA group. And the meetings were closed, but I hadn't let that slow me down before. Now I did, and I only got to the open AA meetings, and I loved them. And for I went to meeting after meeting, and this is over a year. I had this little girl, but I was learning little things around the program. Now, I never took the first step of the Al-Anon program. I took them all for Bob. If he would admit he was powerless over alcohol, everything would be fine. If he would admit he was crazy, I was putting bread in the oven and salt in the refrigerator, but there was nothing wrong with me. Now, normally, I was a very vocal and argumentative person. But now, the frustration of knowing there was a place for him to get help and that he wasn't getting it was absolutely driving me insane. I became the abusive one. When they talk about abuse centers where the wives can go to escape the abuse from their husbands, I shudder every time I see one on television because my husband qualified for one of those centers. When I finish talking, there will be people over there buying the tape, and not because I'm a good example of how Al-Anon works, but they'll be taking it home and saying, "Honey, listen to this. I am so glad I've got you for a wife." You see, I became really violent in my need to control this man. I wasn't listening to anything they said to me in those meetings because it didn't apply to me. I was not powerless over alcohol. I could tie that old boy up to a bed and keep him sober. Somebody reminded me it would have gotten terribly messy after a while. But that didn't matter. I could have done it, and I knew it. And as long as I had this attitude, there was no way Al-Anon could help me. When Bob would come home, he got to like an Al-Anon, though, because it did help a little bit with the mouth. He'd come home and babysit so I could go to a meeting. But then when I'd get home, he would be drunker than ever, and he would say something. Now, I don't know what it was, but he'd always say something that would trigger the fight, and we'd be in a big one. And then he'd say, "What would your Al-Anon friends think of you now?" Well, I really didn't give a darn. And I'd tell him so. And we played games. This was the time in our life when we played games. We played hide-and-go-seek with his billfold. And he would hide it, and the kids and I'd get him up in the middle of the night, and we'd go seek that billfold. And we got good at finding it. One time it was lost from all of us for about 3 days. He didn't know where he put it either. We played King on the Hill with the car keys because I just knew if this man went out and killed somebody in that car that how I had a whole life, you know, stretched out in front of me. If he killed somebody in that car, they were going to arrest him. They were going to put him in jail, and he'd go to prison. And then he'd be sober. And I'd love him sober, but he'd be locked up, and I'd be unhappy. Now, I didn't love him the way he was, but I knew if he was sober, I'd love him. So I had all this pain and anguish, and I fought for those car keys. One of the nights, and I'd been going down on about 18 months, one of the nights we were fighting for the car keys, and I was pregnant. I always was pregnant. But he shoved me away in trying to defend himself, and I slipped and fell. And this feeling, this really nice feeling kind of washed over me, and I thought, well, and I looked up at him and I said, "Well, you have sunk as low as a man can sink. You have struck a lady." And he looked around the room quite concernedly, and he said, "I don't see any." And the rage, the combination of all the resentment and rage and hatred that I felt for what this man was doing in my life come to a head. And the only thing within reach was the fireplace poker. And I grabbed that poker, and I come up off the floor, and I swung that poker at his head with every ounce of strength I had in my body. I wanted him dead. I wanted him dead right there on that spot. He threw his arm up, and I broke his arm. And he started moaning and groaning and saying, "Take me to the hospital." And I said, "Die, damn you. I don't care." And he drove himself over to the hospital, and he comes back with his arm all in a sling, and he would sit there, and he would say, "Look what you did to me." And I'd say, "I wish it had been your head." And I really did. And I was in Al-Anon about 6 years. I was on a serenity retreat, and I asked the priest, I said, have I never felt any shame or remorse for that night? And he says, "Well, honey, some of us are sicker than others." And he says, "In your case, I think you really were sicker than your alcoholic." He says, "Because you were so caught up in the obsession to control him that you couldn't let go of anything. And he said, you were in temporary insanity, whatever. He says, but he says, you have to put that behind you. And he says, you have to forgive yourself. And he says, it's okay, because it is in the past. And so I still don't feel any remorse for that. I'm glad I didn't kill him, but I've never really felt any sorrow or grief or, you know, oh my goodness, why did I do that? I think it was just part of the disease of alcoholism. I think that explains it. I had, after I told that one night, I had a man come up and tell me at a little meeting up in Indiana, he said, thank you so much for telling me how you felt and what you did. And he was crying, and I said, why? And he says, my wife died right before I got sober. And he says, I could not forgive her for the beatings and the physical punishment that she gave me when I was drunk and helpless. And he says, I would go out to her grave and stand there and hate her. And he says, when I go to the grave tomorrow, I'll understand and I won't hate her anymore. And I want to thank you for giving me that. And I told him, I said, well, I said, if that's the only good I ever do in the world, that's good enough for me, because I didn't know why I was this way. I didn't want to be this way. But I did have one redeeming thing. I kept going back to the Al-Anon program. Time and time again, I went back. Now, in this interim, Bob is drinking and getting worse and drinking more and losing jobs, and things are really happening in our life. And in the Al-Anon room, they kept saying to me, and these two mean, hateful old ladies are still there, one on either side of me. Now, the one was an unmarried old lady, and she kept wanting to hold my hand and pat my knee, and she worried me to death. I sat on my hands in meetings just to keep that lady from reaching over and getting a hold of me. I say these things with the greatest respect and love in the world, because that old lady is 82 years old, going on 83. She's still very active. She goes to meetings, and she's my sponsor. And I've needed that mean old lady every time that I've talked to her. You know, I've called her up all full of myself, all full of this self-pity, and all, how could he do this to me? And she'll say, oh, that sweet old boy. I have hung up at that particular time, because who wants to hear that sweet old boy when you're ready to kill him again? Anyway, I did start listening. I had the good fortune to belong to an Al-Anon group in the early days. It was the Pleasure Ridge group, and there were two male Al-Anons, and there were five of us, whatever we are, crazy women. Anyway, the beautiful AA lady that had been there that first night was a part of that AA group. The two of them met on the same night, and we had this big open meeting, and the speaker were two people from down in the country, and when they got to talking, she said, you know, that she had hit her husband in the head with a cast iron skillet, and when he came to in the hospital, he called AA, and he'd been sober ever since. You're ahead of me. That was on a Friday night, and on Saturday morning, I was rushing through Winn-Dixie's aisle, because they have cast iron skillets in Winn-Dixie. And I put two skillets in that cart, one square and one round, and I never will understand why, but I got two cast iron skillets. Not another bite of groceries. Now, I had six or seven kids at home, and I wasn't interested in groceries for those kids. I had two skillets in that cart, and I'm racing to the checkout counter, and somebody's grabbing at my arm, and I'm shaking them off, you know, go away. I've got this thought in my mind. And finally, she gets my attention, and it's this beautiful AA lady, and she says, Juanita, where are you going in such a hurry? And then she looked down in my cart, and she said, oh, no. And I said, oh, yeah. And she says, you're going home with me. And now, I bought those skillets. Now, she's a strong and very personable lady, but she wasn't quite strong enough to keep me from getting those skillets. I still got those skillets. Home, and she poured coffee for me, and she talked to me, and she shared her story with me. And do you know, for the first time in all of this time I had been around the program, I could believe that my husband had a disease, that he didn't want to be the way he was. I could hear it in her. And when she told me of the loneliness that she had, and she was a beautiful woman, but when she told of the loneliness, sitting in at the piano bar, seemingly having a good time, and how she felt apart from and so lost, I could believe her. I couldn't believe you men in AA because I thought you were in cahoots with him. But I could believe this lady, and she opened the door to the Al-Anon program for me. The men in that group helped me because they told me how they felt under pressure. Under the pressure of, I had never thought about my husband getting up every morning and going to a job to feed my children and me and to keep a roof on the house. I'd never given him any credit for that. And it wasn't until these Al-Anon men helped me realize that my husband was really a fine person. He was a decent man. I just couldn't reach him. I couldn't get through the wall of alcoholism. They started to teach me some of the things in the program. They told me the first thing I'd have to do is to release my husband with love, that I would have to stop trying to control his life. And I didn't like that, because God knows if I let go of him, he would lose his job and we'd lose everything. And I really believed that. I let go of him, he lost his job, and we lost everything. But I was able to do this one day at a time by going to meetings and by listening to my sponsor, by listening to the other girls in the group, by listening to these fellow Al-Anons. I learned to release him with love, and he called it rejection. I learned to back away, to keep my mouth shut. Sometimes, I've told somebody earlier this week that I would actually go in the bathroom and stuff a washcloth in my mouth to keep from coming out and telling him how wrong he was and what he was doing. But I learned to do these things. I learned to accept the fact that that if he had to drink, he had to drink and just go on. I started working on myself and my relationship with these children. And when I tell you this story, and I don't mention these children any more than to tell you I had them, that's about all the influence they had in my life. They were just responsibilities. I kept them clean. Boy, did I keep them clean. I was the kind of housekeeper that was under the dust before it lit because I had all this energy. Man, I was, you know, if I hadn't had a big house and a lot of kids, I'd have killed him a lot sooner because I had this pent-up energy and frustration, and I took it out on that house and the kids. They were clean, they were spotless, and they were well-behaved because God knows if they did something to embarrass me, I'd spank them. I mean, that's the kind of mother I was. I was a disciplinarian and a dietitian and a housekeeper, but I was not a mother. I can't remember hugging any of these children. I know I did, but I can't remember it until this point of Al-Anon when they told me that I ought to go home and try to be a good mother, be a better whatever I was. And I went home and tried to make my children glad that I was their mother. And it was a big job because they didn't trust me. I would go to hug them and they'd flinch. You know, they didn't know whether I was going to kiss them or slap them. And I had a really tough road with these children. You see, I didn't know I'd taught them to hate their dad. I wasn't aware of it until Al-Anon started opening up doors for me. You see, Cindy would come in and say, Mama, can we have skates? All the kids in the neighborhood have got skates. And I'd say, no, you can't have skates. We don't have any money. And it's tough to live poor in a rich neighborhood. And she'd say, why don't we have any money? And I'd say, because your daddy's down at the bar drinking it all up. And she'd say, why does he do that? And I'd say, because he doesn't love anybody but himself. And later, when I came to in Al-Anon, and I heard this child tell her younger sisters and brothers, Daddy doesn't love us. He doesn't love anybody but himself. I was just struck with the impact of what I had done to these kids, and I started trying to undo it. They said that Cindy should go to Alateen. She was only 9 and a half years old, but the Alateen group welcomed her with open arms. They were all just right at their senior year in high school, and the group had kind of got boring for them, you know. And here they had this live one, and they were really happy to get her, and they just welcomed her in under their arms. And at this particular time in my Al-Anon life, I didn't mind her being there. But, you know, later, after Bob got sober in the program, I wasn't too keen on this kid going to Alateen. And, you know, maybe letting them know that things were not so rosy at home. But at this particular time, I did. And Cindy's always said that she's so glad that they let her come to Alateen when she was just 9, and they didn't send her home and say, you go home and hate your mom and dad for 3 more years and come back to us when you're 13. And so she did go. She was the first, the oldest child. We were at a point where I was letting go and everything was happening. You know, he was losing jobs and things were really happening in our life. Well, they happened so fast that we ended up moving in with my mother. Now, my mother's another story. She's part of Bob's story because he has a mother-in-law story. I was an only child, and my mother did not like the way this man treated her baby. And my mother died thinking it was a damn shame that he had treated me the way I had, and that it was ridiculous for me to go to Al-Anon because I only did what anybody would have done under the circumstances. And she never understood Al-Anon at all. But she did love Bob after he got sober. But we moved in this big old house together up on top of this hill with the driveway all the way around it. And we're not going to live happily ever after there, I'll guarantee you, because we had these 7 babies. I was pregnant with an 8th one. And we're living there together. My mother's paying all the bills. And the kids had 3 bosses. You know, we'd sit down to the table and the kids would say, I don't want these potatoes. And Mother would say, eat those damn potatoes. And Bob would say, they don't have to eat those potatoes. And the kids would look to me, do we have to eat the potatoes or don't we, Mom? And no matter what I said, I was wrong. If I said, eat the potatoes, then Bob would get up and go get drunker. And if I said, you don't have to eat the potatoes, then my mother would get into a snit and tell us who was paying for those damn potatoes. And it was just bedlam in that house. I went up to school to a parent teachers conference, and at this parent teachers conference, the teacher who had this oldest child of mine was sitting there, and she said, you know, Miss Wessel, if I didn't know you so well, and mind you, I'm altar sodality president and PTA president and room mother, and you know, no one must know there's a problem in our home. You got to be all things to all people. And so she says, if I didn't know you so well, I would think there was an alcoholic problem, because Cindy acts just exactly like I did when I was in school and my dad's drinking was so bad. And I said, really? I said, what happened? And she says, well, she says, nothing really happened, she says, except that I grew up to hate my mother. And I said, why did you hate your mother? Did she drink too? And she says, no, I hated her for making me live in the hell we were living in. And I got up out of that chair. I don't even remember saying goodbye to her or anything. And I left. And because I had a babysitter, I went down and I filed suit for divorce after almost 3 years in Al-Anon. I went to that lawyer, and this time I told him, I said, I'm not kidding. I want a divorce because I cannot help him, and he evidently doesn't want any help. And I said, and I have got to do something to make life more normal for the children and I. And you know, I think the alcoholics have a built-in antenna or radar for when we are not bluffing. They know when we mean it. Of course, you know, how many times can you do it to them? But that particular day when they served Bob with the papers, he did what he always does when we have a crisis. He goes fishing to think about it. And by the time he gets back, we've worked it out and everything's okay, you know. So this time he did exactly the same thing. He packed up and went fishing. But my mother was a different story. She got real busy. She had all the locks changed on the house. She had a restraining warrant taken out because with the divorce in process, she could get a restraining warrant to keep him off the property. And she was really busy, and she spent every morning and evening saying, you are not going to let him come back. You have been crazy to live with him this long. I don't know what's wrong with you, but I'm putting a stop to it. And she preached from morning to night that this was it. And so 3 weeks later, when Bob came back, he didn't like the way his key didn't fit the door, and he broke it down. And my mother didn't like him breaking down her door. And they got into it. And I was upstairs getting ready to go to my Al-Anon meeting. And I was practicing enough release that I didn't even go down to get in the fight. I stayed upstairs dressing until I heard Cindy screaming. And I ran out of the room and said, "What's the matter?" And she says, "Daddy has a gun. He's up in the attic, and he's going to kill us." And I said, "Oh, Daddy's not going to kill anybody." And she says, "He's up there." And she had all the little kids cornered over in the corner of the hall. And I opened the attic doorway, and sitting there in the top step of the attic with his 12-gauge shotgun was my husband. And I looked up the barrel of that gun, and I said, "What are you doing?" And he said, now he'd been gone for 3 weeks, he said, "Honey, your mother wants me out of here." And he says, "I can't live without you and the kids. Don't let her make me go." And, you know, for the, really, I could see that he really meant this, that he couldn't live without the kids and I, and that he was sick. And I just closed the door on him. And I went downstairs, and when I got to the bottom landing, my mother was coming out of her room with her .410 shotgun. And she said, "I'm going upstairs and getting rid of the problem." And you know, for just a minute, now I'm an only child and I love my mother, but I thought, you know, if the, she goes up and they kill each other, the kids and I can live in peace. Sanity returned, and I did try to stop her. I said, "No, Mother, you're not going up there." And there we stand. Now, this is a warm day in November, and the front door was open, and the screen was all it was between us and the outside. And see, in the meantime, my mother had called the police because she had this restraining warrant. Well, we're standing there in the front of the living room door struggling over this gun, and when the police came to the door, they didn't want any part of this. They went out and called out the riot squad, and they didn't know the nut was in the attic. So our house was totally surrounded by police cars with the red lights back in those days, going whoop, whoop. The radios were on full blast, riot on Iroquois Parkway. And I walked to the door and looked out, and I thought, "My God, what must the neighbors think?" 3 years in this program, and they were still running my life. That's how little progress I'd made. Anyway, I opened the door, and I lean out, and I said, "Officer?" And their little heads popped out from behind the trees. And they had these big tear gas guns. They were going to shoot tear gas into our house. And I said, "What are you going to do?" And they told me, and I said, "You can't. I've got children upstairs." And that gave them a little problem, you know. And I said, "Can I call AA? And this one cop stuck his head around the tree, and he says, "Hell, lady, we don't care who you call." So I called AA that night for my husband. And miracles had long time been working in our lives, but that night the women in the church had had a little church circle meeting, and they had taken the regular Al-Anon room, and the Al-Anons were meeting in the office where the telephone was, usually locked up where no one could get to it. And they were able to answer the phone, and AA came that night to our home. Two AA members, my husband's brother, and a priest was there at that meeting that night, and they came to our house. You know, that took a lot of courage to come to a house where two people had guns and wouldn't give them up. The police were outside with the tear gas guns and their riot squads, and they came, and they came right through the whole mess. I still marvel at the courage, and I'm still grateful for the love they showed when they did that. Norman went right on upstairs and got Bob to give up his gun. It took the two AA members a little longer, but they finally got Mother to give up hers. And they gave her one of her sleeping pills, and they tucked her in. And they came down. And they came down the steps, and they had Bob in tow. And they said, they told me, they said, "We're going to take him out to Our Lady of Peace," which is a local mental hospital. And I said, "We haven't got any money." And Norman says, "We'll work something out." And so I'm sitting there. Now, mind you, I had filed suit for divorce. I hadn't seen this man for 3 weeks. He had tried to kill us all just prior to this. And he turns and leans back in the living room door. I'm still sitting with the phone in my lap. And he says, "Bye, honey. See you in a little bit." So You know, I can't describe to you the despair I was in at that moment. I really can't. And those of you who have been where I was that night know. And those of you who have never had that kind of despair, I couldn't describe it if I talked all night. But I was so alone. I was so lost. And I was just so apart from. And when the alcoholic talks about loneliness, I think we in Al-Anon know where you're coming from, because we've been there too. I walked up the steps and went into our bedroom, and I stood there looking out the window, and it was, I don't even know what hour of the morning it was, but it was very dark, just a few lights on the houses down below us, and I just despaired of any help. I didn't believe if there was a God that he loved me, because if he loved me, how could he let these things happen? And you know, I was expecting an eighth baby. We didn't have any insurance. We didn't have any money. We were living on the charity of my mother, and her, you know, she was very volatile. And I didn't know how long that would last. And I could hear this lady, this mean, hateful old lady, at that Al-Anon meeting saying, if you're not as close to God as you think you ought to be, reach out. He's right there. You're the one who's moved away. I heard her voice right there in that room. And I physically reached out into the darkness, and I felt a peace that I can't describe. I believe that that's when I took the first step of the Al-Anon program, when I admitted that I was powerless, that I could not do anything, that my life was unmanageable, because I reached out and I said, God, please help me. Now, up to that time, I had bargained with God. I had prayed to him. I had told him what to do. I was very religious. Every day of my life, I went to 6 o'clock Mass just to tell God how to run the day. And I'd go back the next day to tell him how he blew it. I can't ever remember being grateful for anything. What I got was my due. And when I didn't get what was coming, you know, what I thought was my due, then something was wrong with the world. That was my attitude. But I asked God to help me, and I laid down and went to sleep. And when I woke up, the fear that just came over me was overwhelming. I rushed out of that bedroom. The alarm clock had gone off. I rushed out of that bedroom and ran down the hall, and none of the kids' beds had been slept in. From the moment of looking up that stairway into that gun, I had not known where my children were or what they were doing. From that moment, I saw Cindy's closet door was closed, and it's a big walk-in closet. I ran over there and tried the handle, and I said, Cindy. And her little voice was, Mother? And I said, Cindy, it's Mama. Open the door. It's all right. And she opened the door, and she had her six little brothers and sisters on pillows and blankets in the closet floor, locked away. Those children had spent that night in total terror, fear of what was going to happen to them. And I didn't even know it. I wasn't even aware. As long as Bob and I stay close to this fellowship and this program, and we keep going to meetings, we've done this through these years, and our children have never had a night like that again. We came out of there. The AAs called and asked me what I was going to do, and I said, I'm getting a divorce. And the psychiatrist called and asked me what I was going to do, and I told him I was getting a divorce, and he said, good. He said, I've been in there to talk to him, and he says, there's not an honest bone in that man's body. He said, he will die a hopeless alcoholic. And I believed him. You see, I'd been coming here, and I'd been listening to you people, but I believed that psychiatrist. And I was going through with this divorce. Well, about a week later, or 3 or 4 days later, our second oldest daughter's birthday was November the 13th. And I turned around. I was cooking her supper, and I turned around, and there stood Bob in the doorway of the kitchen. And I said, oh, my God, my mother will be home in 30 minutes, and we'll have to go through the whole thing again. And he said, no, I've been talking to your mother. Now, my husband and my mother did not talk. They argued and screamed and cursed, but they didn't talk. And this, he says, but I've been talking to her. And she says, if it's okay with you, I can stay for Pam's birthday tonight. And by this time, the kids had come running in the kitchen, and they were delighted to see their dad. And I said, well, if you're sure, Mother said so. And so he stayed for the birthday that night. And I had been asked to talk at a meeting on just not more than 3 blocks away from our house. And I thought, I got to call and cancel. I can't leave these two here together. And I thought, no, Al-Anon says to lead your own life and to let things, to let go and to release. And I announced after supper dishes that I had to go to my meeting, and I got up and left my husband and my mother together, not knowing what would be there when I came home. And when I came home from that meeting, they were still sitting at the same table drinking coffee. And my mother says, he wants to stay. And I said, oh. And she says, if he stays, he takes one drink, the whole kit and caboodle of you hit the streets. I won't turn a hand or do anything to help you again. And fear struck really deep. You know, security was something I needed with all these babies. And I just couldn't believe it. And Bob looked across the table and he said, Juanita, I can't promise you anything except I don't want to go back to the hell we've been living in, and I'm willing to give AA an honest try. And you know, this is the kind of talk that I'd been hearing around the meetings. This was what I needed to hear, and I said, then stay. And I wish I could tell you that we started out our AA and Al-Anon life and our children in Alateen, and we lived happily ever after, but you'd know I'd lie about something else. Because now he got sober, and I didn't like him. I was expecting this eighth baby, and I was in the later months, you know, and he's sober, and it's coming on Christmas time, and I want to buy the kids some toys, and he says, we haven't got the money. And I thought, damn you, you've drank up enough money to buy them, you know, cars. And the resentment started building again. And he was going to meetings every night, and he was coming home telling me messages from my friends. They weren't his, they were mine. I've been cultivating those friends for 3 years. And he'd come in, I would be up all day taking care of these seven little children in this huge old house, and my mother, and waiting on her. And he'd come in from a meeting at 10:20, and he'd sit down in this big old chair, and he'd say, bring me a bowl of ice cream. He doesn't know how many times he almost got that on his head. I hated this man sober. You know, when they sober up, they tighten up like bark on a tree. And I was having to ask him for money. I hadn't done that for years. I'd been the one to keep things together. And I resented it. Now, I wasn't going to meetings either because, you see, it was more important that he go. And we couldn't afford a babysitter, so I stayed home so that he could go. And I wore my halo real well. I became the martyr. And one night, shortly before the, it was after the birth of this little girl, that I was sitting there on the floor in the middle of the hallway crying because things were out of hand. The boys were fighting in the bathtub, and the girls were not getting in bed and getting themselves ready for school like I thought they should. Nothing was going my way, and I was sitting in the middle of the floor crying. And I could hear this same old mean lady saying, do you know there are women who actually get jealous of their husbands' work and need for AA? And I thought, they must be crazy, when I was going to meetings. And there I sat in the middle of the floor, hating him for going to those meetings, hating. Nothing had changed in my life. I was miserable. And how dare he have fun when I was still miserable, after all I'd been through to get him happy. So I said, when he came home that night, I met him at the door with his ice cream, and I sat him down in his chair, and I said, we have to talk. I said, I need these meetings too. And if we're going to have any kind of life, I'm going to have to get to my Al-Anon the same as you have to get to your AA. And he says, you're right. No argument. I expected one. See, when I talked and he listened, we were having a conversation. When I talked and he said no, we were having a fight. And this night he said, you're right. And so we started working it out where we could get a babysitter. My mother still lived in the house, but she would not babysit so I could go to Al-Anon. She did not think it was necessary. She kept watching him through his whole first year. But you know, the year when he celebrated his first AA birthday, she was right there, delighted that he was sober and happy for him. She made every one of his first 13 AA birthdays until she got out of her deathbed to come to his last 13th birthday. Because she was so proud of what he was doing in AA, and she wouldn't have given me a 10-cent token to ride a bus to an Al-Anon meeting because she didn't think that it was that I should go. But that's over the dam now. Bless her heart. My mom died in 74. But I got back into Al-Anon, and Bob was going to AA, and we were just living great. We were the best darned AAs and Al-Anons you ever saw. We practically became Mr. and Mrs. AA and Al-Anon in our area. If you didn't believe me, I'd have told you so. We even got to talk at the International, and I'll never forget this false modesty. I said, what can I tell people who've been around the program so much longer? And this one old-timer was sitting there, and he says, do you know anybody who can tell your story better than you can? And I said, no. And he says, well, then just shut up and do it. And I looked at him, and I said, flustered, and he says, it's just a lot of false pride that makes you agonize over doing something like that. And so I've never agonized over it. I get a little shaky, but I don't agonize. I'm here to do just that. The things I tell you about the Al-Anon program are how they work in my life. I do not speak for the program. I learned to release my husband. I learned to do things for free and for fun. Now, when I tell you we became so active in the program, and we really did, our daughters were talking in Alateen, and we were talking, and we were traveling around the country, and we were so good at this. But, you know, there were still some things at home that were not quite right. We still could fight over money. We could fight over an unkind word, which is tick one of the other of us off. And I've spent many a time saying, you know, if he was working his program, he wouldn't have said that. And Bob was doing the same thing to me. We could go to an AA and Al-Anon meeting and have this fierce fight in the car. I mean, just going at it, tooth and nail, and open the car door and get out and turn on. And we'd be the best darned AA and Al-Anon you ever saw in that meeting. Help people, just work out their problems for them. And then we could go back to that car and pick that quarrel up where we left off. But you know, God is good to us. He allows us time to grow and to mature in this program, and he gave us that time. We had to get to a place where we hurt again, where we were hurting inside, where we had that pain right there. And you know, when I talk about that pain, that was the pain that drove me when Bob was drinking. You see, I was hurting, and I wanted to hurt him so he could feel that pain and stop hurting me. And in Al-Anon, they told me that I would have to show him love so he could feel love and return it to me. They taught me how to love my husband. I know that I loved him from the day I met him and married him, but it wasn't the right kind of love. It wasn't the kind of love that you give for free and for fun, expecting nothing in return. I found out that happiness had to come from within me. I found out that no one could make me happy, and that I darn well better not allow someone else to control my happiness. They don't have the right. I'm the one who has that right. I found out how to use the serenity prayer in my life, that I am powerless over persons, places, things, and circumstances. The only thing I can change in my whole world is my attitude towards what's happening to me right now. If it's happening to me, it's part of God's will. There was one lady who used to come around the Al-Anon program, and she was a very sweet, very kind lady, and she used to sit at the meetings, and every time it came her turn to say something, she'd always say, let go and let God. And I'd think, kill her, somebody. You know, I just wasn't the kind to take the sweet people. And this lady used to rasp on my nerves, and one night after a meeting, I couldn't stand it anymore, and I got a hold of her arm, and I said, how do you let go and let God? And it didn't fluster her at all. She just looked into my eyes and smiled and said, you'll know when you do it, honey. We don't want to hear things like that when we're there to get them sober. Later on, I was able to listen to this lady, and I was able to let go and let God in my life. Finding a God that was a God of love. I had been raised in Catholic schools and with Catholic nuns, and I don't say this with prejudice or any resentment, but bless their hearts, they really have a terrible picture of hellfire and damnation, and they had given it to me. I really believed that if I didn't walk this line, that God was going to throw thunderbolts down and get me. And you know, good as I was, he was doing all these bad things to me, so God only knows what would happen if I did something wrong. And I did start working on the program. I took an inventory, and the first one was all good. I was a terrific person back then. You have to understand this. Then they went to work with me at a group level, and the second one I took was all bad. And I cried, and I cried, and I called my sponsor, and she says, "Honey, this one isn't any more honest than the first one." I hung up on her again. But I called her back and I said, "How do I get honest?" And she says, "Work on it. Try being honest in everything you do and say and think." Well, I didn't know how to think honest. I'd been thinking this way I was for so long, I didn't know how. They had to take me by the hand and lead me through this. But you know, the things that I learned through pain in this program, I have never had to experience again. Because I learned a lesson. And this is true of all of us. If you learn the lesson through pain, you don't ever have to experience it again. Our kids grew up in Alateen, and every one of them went to Alateen. The youngest are 20 and 21. They're at home now. We just married our son, got him married to a beautiful young lady about 2 weeks ago, and they're just back now from Hawaii from their honeymoon. And things in our life are really good. You know, I never knew what happiness was until this program started working in our lives. I want to thank the committee for asking us to come down here and share with you. I know I've talked a little over time, and I'm sorry. I get carried away. But I do want to thank the committee and Marge and George for being so good to us this weekend. I do want to tell you that if I haven't said anything to help you to think that Al-Anon will work in your life or with someone else, keep coming back. This program does work. The miracle of it is beautiful. You know, if my husband had to have an incurable disease, you see, my mom and dad and his dad died of cancer, and it was a terminal disease, and it was a very, very bad death. But if my husband has to have an incurable disease, I'm so glad it's alcoholism. Because the treatment are meetings and conventions with people like you. And I can't tell you how much I appreciate the love that you have given me this weekend. Right before I talked, so many were coming up and hugging me and kissing me and wishing me well and saying, you know what, God loves you and so do I, and all these wonderful things. I can't imagine another way of living. We still have the pain of ordinary living. We still live together in a house full of children and alla dogs and alla cats and all these things. And we still have problems. But today, we know what to do about them, and we know how to cope. And on the way down here, I have to share this with you, and then I will quit. It used to be a real problem with me to go in a restaurant or someplace nice with Bob because he always flirted with the waitress. And I would let him know how I felt about it. You know, I was not very quiet about anything. I didn't believe in suffering in silence. And we went in this restaurant down in Bowling Green, and this cutest little old waitress, and over-endowed in many places, says to us, "Walk this way," and she jiggles off. Well, I tried to jiggle off behind her, but I got a hitch in my get-along, and I couldn't do it. And you know, Bob actually mentioned that my hitch was pretty cute. He didn't say a word to that little waitress, so we have come a long way. Thank you.